From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. Lost amid tough talk on trade, tariffs, and Trump versus Trudeau at the G7 this weekend, a Paris-style agreement on marine waste. Here's the Canadian Prime Minister Saturday.
Five of us also agreed to a plastics charter, which speaks to our common resolve to eradicate plastic pollution.
It's as simple as this. You've got a choice, the planet or plastic. That big challenge dominates this month's National Geographic. Millions of tons of plastic go into the ocean every year. Bags, bottles, straws, fishing nets, killing millions of marine animals, degrading even into smaller plastic particles. An ocean Armageddon. This hour on Point, our planet tangled in plastic and the hard choices we need to make. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the world's plastic problem? What are you doing, if anything, to combat it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org and on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Seattle, Washington is Laura Parker, a staff writer for National Geographic who covers climate change and marine environments. You can find a link to her big piece in this month's issue headlined, "We Made Plastic, We Depend on It, Now We're Drowning in It." It's at our website, onpointradio.org. Laura Parker, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me.
How did we get here? Plastics are a fairly recent innovation in world packaging, in world consumer products.
Plastic has not been around really for very long, and we trace it in our piece to the 1950s, post-World War II, when a lot of these plastics were developed, and we feature a photograph from an old Life magazine in our piece, which shows the celebration of a throwaway culture, and it shows a family throwing objects up in the air, and as we might say, the trouble started when all that stuff hit the ground. This was supposed to liberate the American housewife from the chore of having to do dishes every day or these kinds of things. And it just grew from there, and plastic production has roughly doubled every decade or so since then and left us to where we are today.
It would appear from your reporting that part of what makes plastic so wonderful and so infinitely usable is part of what makes it such a problem to have around. It's persistent. It's cheap to make, and it's discarded without much of a thought in much of the world.
That's correct. Today, the figures are about 40% of plastic that's manufactured is made for single use. The term single-use plastic, you'll hear that repeated a lot, and that's counts for everything from the bulk plastic styrofoam that your computer comes in when you receive your shipment, to the thin, filmy plastic that wraps sandwiches that you buy every day at the lunch counter.
You know, I hesitate a little bit because I know that in many places in the world, plastics have made life better, even as they've fouled environments. People who used to perhaps buy milk from a barrel and have it ladled out into a container that they brought from home, now get it in a plastic bag that you snip off the corner. It's kept fresh. It's kept sterile until the single use is ready. In places where the drinking water is often dodgy, you'll find that people are now drinking bottled water that is more likely and more often safe and pure and fresh and clean. There are a lot of places in the world where it's been a revolution to have the availability of cheap, plentiful plastic.
That's right. And don't leave out the first world. Plastic revolutionized medicine. Plastic helped get us to the moon. The point here is plastic bad. All of us know somebody whose life was saved by plastic, whether it was a plastic bicycle helmet, whether it was an incubator in a hospital, whether it was an airbag. The point is what happens to plastic trash, what happens to the single-use plastic once it used. What happens in countries where billions of articles and products are imported every year into countries that have absolutely no capacity to clean up the plastic waste afterwards? That's the question.
And that's the flip side of those for instances I was just giving you, because in a lot of those places, those pieces of material are piling up on the side of roads, in drainage ditches, in piles, in villages and towns. When I was covering the aftermath of the hurricane in Haiti, I remember looking over a wall next to a cafe and maybe a 5 or 6 foot deep trench filled with empty plastic water bottles. There was no good way to get rid of them.
That's right. In some of these countries, especially in Asia and in Africa, you will see the real connection between plastic and poverty. And we really need to focus on figuring out a way to collect that material or dispose of that material, or to not have that material have a new way to redesign plastic products so that not so much of it ends up as waste. That's the challenge.
What happens to plastic after that single use, after even a few uses? If a plastic implement is discarded, ends up in a body of water, ends up in a landfill, ends up just sitting somewhere in a town or road or in a village, does it fall apart? Does it go into much smaller pieces? What happens to it over time?
Well, it depends on where it ends up. If a lot of it ends up in the ocean, which is cool, by comparison to the rest of the place and dark, it will slowly break down over time into what we have called microplastics, which are small bits of plastic that are less than a fifth of an inch long. And a lot of that is consumed by marine life. If it's in a landfill, hopefully it stays in a landfill. And if it's just lying around, in some places, it can, you know, as you mentioned, clog drains, create pools of water that flood and create a mess that people just really can't escape from.
Earlier this month, a whale died on the shores of Thailand after swallowing more than 17 pounds of plastic. Here's an excerpt from the UK's Sky News with the report.
This pilot whale is stranded, starving to death. If the team leave it, it will drown. It cannot eat because its stomach is full of plastic. These pictures after its death show the 80 plastic bags found inside the whale, 8 kilograms of human waste, slowly killing it.
Why would an animal eat a plastic item in the ocean?
A lot of plastic that is spent in the ocean for a while, it begins to absorb the smell and algae and small marine organisms, and it starts to smell like food. And small bits of plastic, the microplastics, which bags can break down into, look like food. And so it's often confused for food by marine organisms that eat it. I'm sure you've all heard the story that turtles mistake plastic bags for jellyfish, which is their primary preferred food.
In 2015, Texas A&M graduate student Christine Figener traveled to Costa Rica to study sea turtles for her doctoral dissertation. While examining one male turtle, she and her colleagues found something lodged in the turtle's nostril.
That's plastic?
It's not a freaking straw. Don't tell me it's a freaking straw. Keep it, please. We're going to look at that later on. I mean, that is just stupid. I mean, it looks like the straws that we have with, like, black or red stripes.
Yeah.
It's a freaking straw up her freaking nostril.
And straws, it would seem, Laura Parker, are one of the easiest things for us to get rid of, and yet we don't.
Yeah, that I just want to say that video is on YouTube. It goes on for about 8 minutes. It's painful to watch, but I think it serves a purpose. It's been viewed by, last count, I mean, it's probably more now, 12 million times. And they did finally get the straw out of the turtle's nostril, and the turtle was put back in the water and, as far as they know, survived. Straws are a relatively easy thing, I think, to deal with. And it's interesting, just in the last year or so, that straws got a lot of attention. There is a lot of movement on that front in terms of communities and counties and cities trying to some of are considering banning them. Some are recommending that, and restaurants are taking this on themselves. Some restaurants are now declining to serve drinks with a straw automatically. They're saying if you need one, please ask for one. So I think you'll see a lot of movement on that particular issue going forward.
Boy, that would seem to be the single-usiest of single-use items, a drinking straw.
I think you're right about that.
And they used to be made out of paper. You know, I don't want to make myself sound like I'm 120 years old, but, you know, paper straws were pretty common, and then they were eclipsed by plastic straws.
And paper straws are coming back in, they're being remanufactured, and you can also, I think you can find metal straws that will be reusable, and people can carry them with them, and those would be especially helpful for those with medical conditions who need to use a straw when they drink.
We're discussing plastic pollution in the world's oceans and what we can do about it. You can join the conversation. What do you want to know about the different types of problem plastics? Should federal, state, or local governments step in? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about plastic pollution, especially in the world's oceans. You can join the conversation. Are you in favor of bans on bottles, bags, or even plastic straws? How much responsibility falls to government or corporations? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Laura Parker, a writer with National Geographic, who wrote this month's cover story about plastic pollution. Joining me now from Washington is Jenna Jambeck, a professor of environmental engineering at the University of Georgia. Her research focuses on plastic waste and marine debris, and she's the co-creator of the Marine Debris Tracker app, which allows people to report marine debris or litter anywhere in the world. Jenna Jambeck, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me.
There are fabulous stories of enormous, multi-thousand square mile patches in the ocean of accumulated plastic waste. How does it get there?
Well, first of all, these accumulation zones don't look like islands, and I want to be clear about that because some people think that it's something that you could walk on. But in many cases, as Laura described earlier, the plastic is microplastic, and so sometimes the ocean can look pristine, and yet the plastic is there. We know that a major portion of the plastic comes from land and from mismanaged waste that you and I generate every day. And that can be either blown or washed directly into the ocean or blown or washed into a river that's fairly near the coast and get to the ocean that way.
And currents carry it along with other pieces from other places, and it just accumulates together into these patches or gyres?
Right, yeah. So there's five really well-known gyres in the ocean, and those tend to be where the plastic will accumulate. The plastic that is floating, though, and it is the ocean currents. We also know that plastic moves in the ocean from wind as well. So there's a few different variables in how it moves around there. But yeah, in these five major gyres, it's where you will find the floating plastic. Of course, some of it also sinks.
Do those create dead zones? I mean, is there less likely to be fish, less likely to be ocean birds, less likely to be all the life that we associate with pristine ocean?
So we know that those animals do interact with this plastic. We know that over 700 different species of seabirds have consumed plastic. And we know a lot about sort of these individual animals. You mentioned the whale earlier that consume plastic. But we don't know for sure these larger effects on the population scale and larger in terms of what this plastic is having on our ecosystem.
I read one study, and I want to run this by you just to make sure it's not hyperbole, that either now or soon, the amount, the weight, the accumulated weight of all the plastic waste in the world's oceans will be equal to the amount of biomass in the world's oceans. So if you put on a scale, all the fish, all the corals, all the other living things and plants and other organisms, it would about equal that of all the plastic junk in the ocean. Is that right?
So that estimate was made about for 2050, and I believe it was only for fish. But I think in terms of our thoughts about that, the ocean is 70% of our planet, and whether or not we know exactly the quantity of biomass of fish, I think that remains in question. So I typically don't use that. I know that our annual input is set to double or more than double by 2025 if we don't have an intervention from the annual input that we're seeing now. And we're taking out tuna every year and putting about the same amount of plastic in. So that's a good comparison, too.
Jenna Jambeck is a professor of environmental engineering at the University of Georgia. She joins me along with Laura Parker, a writer for National Geographic, whose cover story is headlined, "We Made Plastic. We depend on it. Now we're drowning in it." Norfolk, Virginia, right on the water, is our first stop. Linda, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Ray. My feeling is that we need the manufacturers to participate in this immediately. I, about 2 years ago, started to avoid plastic in my purchases. I carry my straw with me. I take my own cup into the, coffee shop. Why do I have to buy my toilet paper wrapped in multiple layers of plastic and paper towels? And why can't I buy my water in paper milk cartons? When I go to the cheese counter, they wrap it in plastic. I want it wrapped in paper. And it's very difficult to be a responsible consumer when the manufacturers don't participate.
Well, Linda, apparently you feel that it would be easy to substitute. Would it be, Laura Parker? Can manufacturers become a big part of the solution? Or is it really something that lies with consumers and using the accumulated weight of their preference, the way Linda's doing in Norfolk, Virginia?
I think Linda makes a good point. This problem is so large that this is something that we as the global community is not going to ban our way out of. The industry will have to play a significant role in dealing with this if we really want to solve this issue. That said, that it remains to be seen how that is going to play out. In Europe, there are more regulations and taxes on the industry in terms of helping them deal with the end of product life, end of life part of the product. And other places, as I mentioned, have banned things. Kenya banned bags and with the harshest penalties on the planet, and they have been happy with the reduction in the number of bags going there. But I think the industry is also paying attention now to what consumers are saying on this issue, and I think there'll be some movement on that. I can't tell you at what rate or how quickly, but I think this is an issue that has now managed to capture the attention of the full planet, and that includes the manufacturers of plastic.
Even with taxes in a lot of American localities on single-use plastic shopping bags, the United States, 5% of the world's population, let's remember, still produces the lion's share of those single-use plastic bags that foul the environment. Jenna Jambeck, is it a false hope, because I keep hearing it speculated about, that degradable plastic, plastic that falls apart, plastic that includes sizable portions of natural materials like fibers from plants, are part of our hope.
Yeah. First of all, Linda would probably be really interested in this plastic-free aisle that they have at a grocery store in Europe, and they're trying to start those in places, and it would make it much easier for her to make the choices that she wants to make. So biodegradable polymers are sort of the cutting edge of the new materials research now. Can we make materials that behave like plastic in terms of what we like about it, but then don't have these unintended consequences if it does get mismanaged? Even if something does biodegrade, we still want to manage it in our materials management system, but it would be nice if we could home compost it, for example. So there are some polymers that are still not widely in use yet that are promising in this regard. And so researchers and pilot studies are on that right now.
We'll go next to Winchester, Virginia, a lovely part of the state that you wouldn't want to see covered in plastic. Brian, welcome to the program.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
Okay.
I just wanted to make a comment regarding the plastics and everything. I've seen some YouTube videos where they're actually doing studies in Europe where they're making asphalt out of plastic now. And it's actually starting to be proven that it's better for, like, potholes and stuff like that. Like in the United States, you get a pothole or a dip in the road, you got a hole in the road, basically, and they got to come out and patch it. And from the videos and everything I've seen, when they actually use the plastics and everything, it has the ability to flex. And actually helps reduce potholes and damage to people's tires and everything else going down the road. So,
well, that's a promising sounding thing. It would take a lot of things out of the waste stream because heaven knows we're making a lot of roads everywhere in the world. Laura, Jenna, any response to Brian in Virginia?
I think that's taking place in the Netherlands. The plastic made it to help not only patch things but also build roads. There are innumerable products now that are being made out of plastic and plastic waste. Everything from fence posts that are going up in ranches in Brazil and elsewhere in South America to roofing tiles to all kinds of things. And I think that we're just at the front edge of that, and I think you're going to probably see that expand.
I want to turn now to Ted Siegler, a resource economist and environmental consultant. He's a partner at DSM Environmental Services, a waste management consulting firm in Windsor, Vermont, where he joins us. Ted, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Jenna and Laura.
Well, as you think about inventing some of the solutions to take some of that garbage out of the waste stream, out of some of that plastic out of our solid waste stream, where does the burden lie? What are some promising solutions?
Well, we've been recycling some plastic for a long time, and the gentleman who called about the road patch is certainly, that's another example of all of the wonders of plastic. It has a huge capacity to be substituted for a lot of different products, but we are still way behind in terms of recovering most of the plastic that is being generated in the world, and so we're the amount that's being recycled is a small fraction of the total that's being produced every year.
What if we said to producers, you have to be part of the solution?
Well, I as you know, have been a long-time advocate of essentially introducing a 1% fee on the production of plastic resin. And just to give you some sense of what the scale of that would be, if you taxed resin production by 1%, you would generate somewhere between $5 and $7 billion per year in money that could be spent to improve the infrastructure around the world, which gives you some indication that the production of plastic resin is somewhere around $500 billion a year enterprise. So there is certainly potential to generate funds that could be used to start to develop the infrastructure and the institutions that we need around the world to solve this problem.
So a tax as part of the answer. What if you introduced, every time you introduced a product, you had to explain to somebody where this stuff was going to end up?
I'm not sure how that would work. I do think that one of the issues that I've been an advocate for is that many of the large consumer products companies are, their home is in the United States, and their products are used throughout the world. And as someone who has worked in a lot of developing countries, I see that plastic packaging littering the landscape all over the world, and I think that they have a much greater responsibility than they've been willing to undertake so far to be involved in developing that infrastructure around the world.
We see efforts made. The EU is making some. There are small-scale waste generation plants that are bringing rural electrification to places that are fouled with plastic. It's not an ideal response, but it does get rid of the plastic. Can we ad hoc our way out of this, or is there going to have to be some sort of bigger, more cooperative response?
I think it has to be bigger and more cooperative. Part of the problem in many of the countries that don't have the infrastructure is that they are confronted with enormous problems that in some respects dwarf plastics waste management. They're dealing with educational issues, no water or no clean water, no sewer systems, poor transportation systems, and those are almost, in my experience, having worked in them for the last 30 years, those other priorities are greater than for plastic waste. And so I think that there is a need for a more concerted effort, especially by the countries and the companies that are the producers of this material, to intervene to help develop the infrastructure and the institutions that are necessary to begin to change the disposal of plastic.
We'll take a call before the break. Rhinelander, Wisconsin is next. Jill, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Ray, and hi. I just have a comment, a couple of comments. One is when people say, you know, they use it and they just throw it away. There is no away. It's just transported to another location. And another thought is if people would use water like they were camping and they had to carry it in themselves, people would be a whole lot more economical with their water use as well. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jill. What about that idea, Ted, that there is no away? Away is somebody else's here.
Well, it is the case, but I think that being realistic and recognizing that plastic is not going away, that we are going to continue to develop more and more uses for it, and as you pointed out, it has a lot of beneficial uses, such as aseptic packaging for milk, for example. It's a lot better to bury it in a landfill than to release it to a stream bed or have it blowing across the landscape or go into the marine environment. And so a lot of what really needs to be done is, it's as kind of sad as that may seem to people who want everything to be recycled, is that we really just need to start collecting it and disposing of it properly, and then developing continue to increase the development of ways to recycle and recover the plastics that we're generating.
Ted Siegler is a waste management consultant who works on these issues in developing countries. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ray.
Neil writes on our website, disposable plastic is an oxymoron. Small place to start. If you use drinking straws, buy stainless steel ones, bring them with you to restaurants, bring your own food containers to take home leftovers. Rick writes, humans drowning in plastic? Nope. The rest of the fauna kingdom is choking on it. We're discussing plastics pollution in light of a big cover story in this month's National Geographic. You can join the conversation. Does this conversation itself motivate you to change your own behavior as a consumer? Eliminate plastic waste from your life outright. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're looking at the astronomical amount of plastic pollution in the world's oceans. You can join the conversation. What is the solution? Could you adopt a zero-waste lifestyle? I'm talking with National Geographic staff writer Laura Parker and University of Georgia environmental engineer Jenna Jambeck. I want to bring Catherine Kellogg into the conversation. She's a writer and public speaker who lives a zero-waste lifestyle. All of her trash for a year fits into an 8-ounce mason jar. She blogs about all this at her website, goingzerowaste.com. She joins us from Northern California. Catherine Kellogg, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you.
When you're trying to get rid of plastics, what are some of the low-hanging fruit? What are some of the most easily replaced uses that would actually make some difference?
Well, I tell everyone to start with the big four, and the big four is saying no to straws, bringing your own bags to the grocery store, making sure that you have a water bottle when you leave the house, and then saying no to takeaway coffee cups, which are actually lined with plastic and very difficult to recycle. So having your own cup or just asking for a real cup to stay.
And just those four things, would that make a big dent in a country like the United States? Would that make a big dent all by itself?
It would make a sizable dent. Our society relies a lot on convenience, and just taking a few seconds to grab an extra thing to bring with you, a reusable product, would cut down significantly on a lot of waste that's created outside of the home.
Should you be lulled into a false sense of virtue, let's say, by the fact that you know that you've seen park benches made out of milk bottles, and you've seen decking and shingles made out of recycled drinks bottles. Is that really the answer to both the volume and the persistence of plastic solid waste?
Well, I think that using products from the waste stream to create other products is obviously a good thing, but that's just like a boat with a giant hole on it and just using a bucket. You know, we have to find a way to really stop it from all the water from coming in the first place. So I think there are multiple solutions. I always say sustainability is gray because there's no one correct answer. We need a lot of things working at the same time in order to fix the problem.
Are there approaches that even as you're doing your attempted zero waste living, where you know you're more committed, more down for this effort, let's say, than a lot of other people, that you look around and you say, okay, I look at this crowd of people waiting to cross the street. I look at all the people I see on a bus or on a train. Most people would be willing or ready to do this thing. There are things that are easier. Some are easier than others, no?
Absolutely. I don't expect everyone to immediately stop producing all trash. It's more of this is possible. It's showing an example that you can live this way. Does it take a little bit more time? Yeah, but really it's about building habits. And I say it's just like living two ticks to the left because you live normal. I live normal. I do everything everyone else does. I go grocery shopping. I get coffee. I get takeout. But I just do all of it in a slightly adjusted manner. And if people took the time, if they had the time to build a couple of these habits, we could really see a large impact.
In October, CBS News reporter Jonathan Vigliotti visited the Arctic Circle Islands in northern Norway and found trash blanketing uninhabited islands.
We may be on our own, but everywhere we look, there are unwanted signs of life.
So this is a sampling of just some of the things we've found so far. We've got a Coca-Cola carrier. This says on it that it's from Venezuela. We also have what looks like some sort of motorcycle helmet that's been washed up.
Atlanta, Georgia is next. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for the call, Ray.
Welcome.
So I work in film, and last year I've worked on some major films as a sustainability supervisor working for the Green Initiative program. One of the problems I ran into, and I don't know what steps we might be taking in the U.S. because we do have the infrastructure, unlike a lot of these other countries across the globe, for recycling and proper waste management. One of the issues we ran into, though, on a major film, our single daily use is probably more than a household of several weeks or at least a month. And what we ran into is some of these waste management companies don't have the means to operate to recycle properly. Either they don't do single stream or they don't clean. So, for example, if we sent a bag of all recycling and it had one piece of lettuce in it, one of the companies we worked with said they just throw it to the landfill because they don't clean it. So I guess a lot of these issues are also out of the consumer's hands, because I can send my stuff to be recycled, but at the end of the day, if it has food on it and it goes to a specific plant, they might just send it to the landfill anyway.
It's an interesting challenge, Michael, because I think about a film set and all the people often on a long day of shooting, you're feeding a large group of people three meals a day. And to add the facilities that would be necessary to wash metal silverware or reusable plates just seems impractical.
Yeah, and we do our best. Like, for example, on one of the films last year, to limit the use of single-use water bottles, we spent thousands of dollars buying reusable water bottles for everyone on cast and crew. And that cost of just the manufacturing those, looking into, like, where do you find the fine line of it, the manufacturing cost environmentally and financially, where they outweigh the cost of manufacturing of the single-use stuff. And so it becomes, even with people I've worked with, some other people that have done the same stuff, they've taken a different approach on how they deal with the sustainability, because they view it that this cost, most of these people aren't going to reuse this water bottle to equate 4 years worth or 1,000 reuses to equate the same as what it takes for a styrofoam cup. And so a lot of those little policies are out of the consumer's hands, and just trying to figure out what more we can do. As the previous caller, going to a zero waste lifestyle is very helpful. That doesn't really help the film industry, because it's really difficult to go zero waste when you're feeding, as you said, 2-3 meals a day to 200 to 400 cast and crew members. If you're talking about like a major film such as Infinity Wars or any of these big Marvel productions doing $250 million budgets across the globe. So it runs into an issue of there's only so much the consumer can also do, whether they're buying and whatnot. But we also, even at the back end with the recycling plants, even with the infrastructure, there's got to be more to make sure we're able to clean and do the single stream and get it to the recycling plants that they need to, so we can reuse those products for more products or new innovations across the globe to maintain sustainability across the globe.
Catherine Kellogg, any ideas for Michael?
No, I actually can speak to this very specifically, because I happen to be a professional actor and have been on film sets. So one of the things is personal responsibility is huge. So whenever I go on set, obviously I have my own plate, I have my own fork, I have my own bottle. I bring all of those things with me. And I think it's really important that the education is there. So instead of saying, you know, we're going to provide reusables, because I know that is a challenge depending on where you're filming, is really helping other people understand. So maybe it's more about educating the others and asking them to bring their own and talking about the benefits that that will provide. I think that's really important. And as far as the recycling point, is that most of our recycling isn't even being recycled. China put a ban on our recycling as of January 2018 with all bale contamination rates over 1% for paper and plastic. So when it's really important that we do have clean recyclables in order for them to actually be recycled, because right now a lot of our plastic and a lot of our paper is being landfilled all the way across the U.S. And that goes back to taking individual responsibility for how we recycle, what we recycle, and making sure that we are doing it correctly.
Catherine Kellogg is a writer and public speaker who lives a zero-waste lifestyle. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Laura Parker and Jenna Jambeck are with me the rest of the way. Hendersonville, Tennessee is next. Brent, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ray. Thanks for taking my call.
What's on your mind, Brent?
So So I work at a sustainability center and sorting facility in Hendersonville, and it's called Green Village Recycling. And we do commercial and residential recycling, curbside pickup. We also provide for music festivals. A big thing that we've been trying to come to terms with is how that we can implement it in everyday life. So great. Just to echo the reusables, bamboo and hemp alternatives. One of the things we've been focusing on lately is how to deal with the plastic waste that's already been generated. And these are a couple different initiatives that I've been researching and reaching out to. There's one, Ocean Legacy, based in Canada. They do this process called pyrolysis, and they are reclaiming diesel and kerosene from number 2 and 4 plastics. And I believe it's 1 kilogram constitutes one liter of kerosene and diesel and gasoline alternatives. So that's one solution that can be. There's another one by Fusion, based out of the Netherlands, I believe. What they're doing is they're melting down plastics into kind of modular interlocking blocks, kind of like Lego blocks, and they're rebuilding. They're able to build structures, and they put the concrete mesh and then just cover it in concrete, and you can't even tell it's plastic block. So that's another cool one. The other one is using it, reclaimed plastic as filaments for 3D printers, and you can basically print whatever your mind can imagine with that. And those are basically the points that we come to trying to reach out with different initiatives. And it really just comes back to accepting responsibility for the waste that we make. And that comes back internally. People have to look inside and see what they want to leave for future generations. And I feel like we're at a pivotal point where we can make that. We're changing the course of history with each action, and our dollar ultimately is the vote. And basically refusing to use it and being insistent and explaining when people are like, oh, you can't fill up your reusable cup. And I'm like, this is why I want to use my reusable cup. You know, so, and I think I've made all the points that I was trying to make with that.
Oh, that's a terrific rundown of things that private industry is trying to do. Laura Parker?
I think that all of the Catherine and the callers have made good points, and there's a similarity there that I think is worth noting, which is this is not something that is going to be solved by one solution. There will have to be multiple solutions on multiple levels, from the local city council government that wants to ban straws all the way up, as I said earlier, to the industry itself. One of the reasons that we did this plastic project, or the plastic package, and this took up a third of the June issue of the magazine, and it also coincided with the launch of a 3-year campaign by National Geographic, which is the largest campaign it's undertaken in its 130-year history, to draw attention to this subject and to attempt to educate the public about what's going on. There are many places where things can be improved. The recycling in the United States is, we generate, and Jenna can fill the number in on this, but we generate a huge amount of plastic trash compared to other countries in the United States. And we can figure out a better way to recycle, so that the regulations may be uniform crossing county and city lines and so forth. And for individual consumers, they can use their voice to talk about this subject, or to communicate with the manufacturers of the products that they buy.
Jenna, you heard our caller Brent talk about approaches that involve already produced, already existing waste, and mentioned pyrolysis. Is that a promising technology?
Converting plastic back into the oil, you know, much of it comes from our fossil fuels, both oil and natural gas. And so that's sort of one natural step. It's actually a synthetic step, but a step that we could take to utilize and get the energy sort of back out of this material. Sort of any thermal treatment is somewhat also controversial. So I think there are certain contexts and certain settings where I will think that will make a difference.
Hallowell, Maine gets the last word today. Bruce, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for taking my call.
What's up, Bruce?
I'm calling because this happens to be today. I own a bar in Hallowell, and we are actually starting our phase out of plastic straws. We've been thinking about it for some time now, but of course people get set in their ways, and the fear of people not coming in because you didn't have straws kind of bothered us. And then after a while, customers have actually been asking not to have a straw. So we have decided to try it, and we're doing it on a phase-out base. I'm bringing in paper straws to only be served by request. And then after we go through those, hopefully we won't have to use straws. And I've talked to other businesses in Maine that have done this, and they've gotten very few complaints. People have been actually more than happy that the business has been doing it. So I would encourage other business owners, bars and restaurants, to definitely try it.
Less waste. Are you also going to save some money, Bruce?
Well, it's bringing in the paper straws, you pay a little more, actually. But I don't mind taking, you know, doing that, and you know, to make things better. And hopefully we won't even have to carry straws. And that would be, of course, not only helping the environment, but saving a huge amount of money.
Well, good luck with that. I'm glad we caught you on New Straw Day One, the day that you're going into business with this. Thanks a lot for your call. And joining us this hour on the program, Laura Parker, staff writer for National Geographic, who wrote this month's cover story headlined, "We Made Plastic, We Depend on It, Now We're Drowning in It." Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Jenna Jambeck, professor of environmental engineering at the University of Georgia. We appreciate your participation.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bowman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Cozzonis, Allison Poli, Jeremy Relosa, James Ross, Grace Tatter, Gretchen Voss, and Miriam Wasser. We had help from Carolyn Anders. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.